The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article is from the Lifestyle section. Here's how to respectfully disagree. Because it's an election year, and boy, do we need to hear this. This article is by Rosie Hopegood. With the presidential election creeping closer and so many issues at stake, entering political discussions can feel like walking into a landmine. We are more divided than ever, and it often feels like those around us are easily triggered. A study by the Pew Research Center sketches a bleak image. An increasing number of people in the United States view those on the opposite political side as lazy, immoral, close-minded, dishonest, and unintelligent. It's this kind of polarization that can make the months preceding the elections divisive and tough to navigate. Unconstructive disagreements can tear families apart and splinter communities. With 19% of American voters acknowledging that political disagreements have hurt their relationship with a loved one. But even without a looming election, regular, everyday disagreements can be tough to navigate, particularly when it feels personal. A great technique is to pretend you are a student, the good kind. Navigating respectful disagreements takes practice, and it's okay not to be perfect. When we encounter someone we disagree with, it's easy to make assumptions about why they hold their opposing views. It's much more difficult and powerful to lean into our curiosity and try to understand their side of the story. You may come out of these conversations still disagreeing, but certainly with a lot more empathy and understanding than before. Here are five phrases to have in your back pocket for when you're struggling for words in a sticky situation. Number one, thank you for your input. I have never heard it that way. For the times when you know that communicating your point of view is unlikely to be constructive, this is a good way of saying, hey, I hear you, and I have nothing more to offer to this conversation. If we were to disagree instead, even with a polite, I respectfully disagree, we open up room for the other person to challenge our views, which can escalate the tension. If you want to calmly end the conversation, you need to gently shut it down. Number two, I can tell we both care about, insert value, thanks for sharing. This is great for when you hold a shared value. For instance, you may both feel strongly about ending unemployment, but disagree about the means of doing it. This is an effective way of highlighting this unifying factor, thereby making the other person feel seen and respected, while also tactfully ending the conversation. Number three, I would love to continue this conversation, but I want to ensure that I am respectful. Can we come back to it another day? This is a handy tactic for politely delaying a prickly conversation. Use this if you sense that this conversation is unlikely to be constructive because one of you feels triggered or less regulated than usual. This one's also handy for postponing the discussion if there's alcohol involved, or if there are young children around who you'd rather not witness a disagreement. Number four, tell me more. Your best friend, whom you usually see eye to eye with, just told you she believes in timeouts as a disciplining tactic for her children. Since the two of you have connected over nurture-driven childcare, you feel your defenses rise. That's natural. However, if you do not fully hear and understand her position, it's easy for a disagreement to escalate into a conflict. This line may be the single most effective way to respectfully disagree with someone. Instead of jumping in with our opinion, we are leaning into curiosity and allowing the other person to be heard. If, after hearing what she has to say. You don't want to continue the conversation. You can opt for one of the exit strategies above. Number 5. I appreciate that you mentioned, insert point, would you be open to hearing my perspective? Now that you've asked your friend to tell you more about why she believes in timeouts, you understand her reasons. However, you believe that she overlooked some key consequences of this parenting method. When we ask someone this question, we are allowing them to decide if they are receptive to listening to our perspective. If they say no, we're saving time and emotional energy since it was unlikely to be a productive conversation anyway. It is easy to force our ideological views onto those around us, but ultimately it is far more constructive and helpful to set aside our ego and enter disagreements from a place of empathy, respect, and understanding. And we're heading on to an Oprah Insider. Oprah shares where she first found her voice. And this article is by Oprah Winfrey. Hello, Insiders. Last week, I went to see a new Broadway show in New York City called Hell's Kitchen. It is loosely based on the teenage years of Alicia Keys, and it's steeped in all of her wonderful music, both new songs for the score and some of her really, really great classics. And I have to say, you know, it's a good night when the next day you wake up humming all the tunes, and a week later, I'm still singing the songs. The show tells the story of 17-year-old Allie, who lives in a cramped apartment off of Times Square with her protective mom. The apartment building is filled to the brim with all kinds of creative folks, singers, artists, drummers, and trumpet players. And Allie sees herself as just a regular teen, until one day when she follows the sound of a piano playing and discovers the Ellington Room in her building. It's a space in the building where there's a piano and a willing mentor in the form of a woman named Miss Liza Jane. And this is when she discovers her love for playing music. And we all know the rest is her story, history. It got me thinking about my own version of the Ellington Room. This is a room where Alicia would go to practice. For me, it was the Buffalo United Methodist Church, a little white church by a red dirt road in my hometown of Kosciuszko, Mississippi. When I look back, it's truly the place where I sowed the first seeds of what would become my broadcasting career. That's where I did my first Easter speech. I found my voice there, reciting Bible verses in front of audiences since I was 3 years old. So, okay, that was my Ellington Room. This week, I want to ask, was there a room or a place in your childhood where you discovered yourself, your passion, or a person like Miss Liza Jane in this show, Hell's Kitchen, who opened a door for you? As ever, I look forward to hearing your responses in the comments below, and I hope you have a really fruitful, inspiring, stimulating, fully present all the time week, and go well. And below, Insiders, are some comments from some people. This one is by Nick Rondinelli. Dear Oprah and Insiders, last week I also saw a show on Broadway called The Wiz. It reminded me of my school days in drama class where I first learned to express myself with emotion, back in ninth grade. I landed my first role in a play, and my teacher, Miss Jeffrey, taught me how to blend feelings. And this one is by Sparklicking. I have a similar story that reminds me of more of when I specifically made the choice to silence my voice. I was 8 and my mom had bought me a red and black jacket like the one MJ wore in the Thriller video. I thought I was going to be the hottest thing ever to hit the third grade. Instead, I got to school and was bullied so severely about the jacket that I remember crumpling it up in a ball and throwing it at my mother, screaming, "I'll never wear this ugly jacket again." And I didn't. For years, decades really, I stayed safe and played small. I barely made a sound. Still got bullied, though. I didn't really find my voice until I got sober in 2015. I will be 9 years sober on May 16th. 6 years ago, I wrote a children's book called Sparkle On as a love letter to the little boy who felt silenced. I tell that story of the jacket, only it's a pair of sparkly shoes in my book. When I got sober, all that fear went away and I started wearing my trademark sparkly shoes specifically so I would be seen. That silenced, scared, and broken boy grew up to be a big voice in this world. I'm grateful for my MJ thriller jacket because understanding, working through, and setting free that childhood pain is what actually helped me find my power as an adult. And today, I'm never afraid to show the world who I am because that is my sparkle. And this is from SMA4876. Good morning, Oprah and Insiders. The room for me was a Methodist church in California. This is where I was the youth liturgist, the person who leads the church service on Sundays that was designated as Youth Sunday. That experience started when I was about 12 years old and continued throughout high school. I also came back to be a speaker for Youth Day when I was in college. To this day, that experience has inspired me to encourage and motivate young people, and just last week at my alma mater, I was part of a panel that provided career advice to students. Parts of these articles were edited due to time. Over in Skin and Makeup, this is how to get rid of blackheads once and for all. Out, out, damned spot. Clearer skin awaits. This article is by Nadine Jolie Courtney and Brittany Leitner. If you have pores, and all of us do, then you're very likely to have had blackheads at some point in your life. Blackheads are enlarged pores that are filled with oil and dead skin cells that didn't slough away from the surface, explains Nancy Samolitis, MD, a dermatologist in Los Angeles and owner and co-founder of Facial Dermatology and Boutique. Although you may think that the black in a blackhead is dirt, that's a common misconception. Your skin isn't dirty. The black color is actually a result of the clog getting oxidized by the air, says Brian Ginsberg, MD, board-certified dermatologist at Chelsea Skin and Laser and clinical assistant professor of dermatology at Mount Sinai Hospital. Your genes and age play a role in how likely you are to get blackheads. Some people are genetically prone to having larger pores or increased oil production, and both of these are contributing factors for blackheads, says Samolitis. Then, as we age and the skin loses its elasticity, pores can enlarge and develop blackheads. This can occur on the face or anywhere on the body. So tiny, dark pores on your chest and back just might be blackheads too, although you may also have clogged pores, whiteheads, or acne. When the clogged pore isn't open to the air and hasn't oxidized, it'll look more like a small white bump, Samolita says. What's the best way to get rid of blackheads at home? The most effective approach is to fix what's causing the blackheads, namely dead skin and oil, explains Morgan Raubach, MD, board-certified dermatologist and co-founder of LM Medical in New York. Use active ingredients, ideally retinol, to decrease oil production, slough away dead skin cells, and regulate the growth of skin cells. Raubach also recommends other exfoliating methods, including exfoliants or peels. These will slowly remove and then also prevent more blackheads from forming. Look for one containing salicylic acid to dissolve the oil and dead skin cells, she says. Then also use a retinol to normalize skin cell turnover, which prevents clogging in the first place. You can also do extractions, but note, to instantly remove blackheads from your face, grab some Q-tips. With blackheads, since the pores already open, you don't need to use a needle or tool to pierce the skin. Instead, apply gentle pressure around the blackhead to squeeze it out. I prefer using two Q-tips to perform the extractions because they won't damage the skin, like squeezing with fingernails or even a comedone extractor can, Samolita says. They're also clean and won't introduce more oil or grime. Remember, however, that although squeezing out blackheads is satisfying, it doesn't change the reason behind their formation. So they'll keep coming back if extractions are the only method you use, Roebuck says. Continue to incorporate a retinol exfoliating serum or weekly peel into your routine. And to get rid of blackheads on your body, try this. The skin on your body is thicker than the skin on your face, so it can handle a higher percentage of active ingredients like retinols, salicylic acid, and alpha and beta hydroxy acids to remove the blackheads, says Raubach. You can also ramp up how frequently you exfoliate and apply higher strength chemical peels. Know that if products aren't cutting it, a dermatologist can help. Some blackheads on the back and body can be quite large, causing the pore to be irreversibly damaged, Semolitis says. Even if you do extract the blackhead and the pore is so large that it will soon fill back up, a dermatologist can do a small surgical excision to close and heal the skin. Do DIY recipes like toothpaste work? Forget what you've heard about potentially using toothpaste to dry up your blackheads. On this DIY beauty hack, Semolitis is crystal clear. Toothpaste does not work for blackheads. As mentioned above, gentle exfoliants like a serum or peel with salicylic acid is best. Then, if the blackheads truly won't go away, progress to a dermatologist. Will my blackheads ever permanently go away? If it seems like you're constantly fighting a losing battle against blackheads, it might not just be your imagination. Some people are genetically prone to developing blackheads, and they can always come back again, says Semolitis. Regular use of salicylic acid and retinol can keep them at bay, but often won't clear them completely. Besides talking to your doctor about excisions, you can ask about an oral retinoid like Accutane. This prescription is usually prescribed for severe cystic acne. However, it will shrink oil glands permanently and potentially cure blackheads. Still, this is not recommended for someone with a mild case. But overall, if you're following a proper blackhead-tackling skincare regimen, you can start to see long-term relief. Blackheads can improve dramatically with retinols, salicylic acid, and regular exfoliation, assures Raubach. What to consider? There are a few things to keep in mind when shopping for a serum, cleanser, or mask that can help with blackheads. The first is price. Depending on your budget, you might want to stick with drugstore finds that can be just as potent as more expensive products. Check out the active ingredients and their percentages. If you struggle with chronic blackheads, you might want to choose a product that has a high concentration of key ingredients like salicylic acid or retinol. Be sure to apply moisturizer to counteract their drying effects. How we chose. The products listed below are chosen based on the advice given by Dr. Raubach, Dr. Semolitis, and Dr. Ginsberg. They contain the recommended ingredients to help fight blackheads. They're also chosen by editor reviews and firsthand experience. So the first one on the list is called Skin Medica. Skin Medica Retinol, 0.25 complex, 1 fluid ounce. It's $64 on Amazon, $58 at Walmart, and $64 at Dermstore. The second one is Pore Release, and it's $20 at hercosmetic.us. Then we have Kiehl's, and that's K-I-E-H-L'S. Since 1851, Kiehl's Mini Rare Earth Deep Pore Minimizing Cleansing Clay Mask, 0.95 ounces or 28 milliliters. It's $26 at Sephora, $16 at Walmart. And then the Ordinary Retinol 1% in Squalane, the Ordinary Retinol 1% with Squalane. It's $9 at theordinary.com. Paula's Choice Exfoliator, it's $35 at paulaschoice.com. Geske, that's G-E-S-K-E, Micro Dermabrasion Blackhead Remover, 7-in-1. It's $60 at geske.com. Duo, the Cleansing Balm, $40 at chicobeauty.com. Curology Liquid Pore Exfoliate, $18 at Amazon. Province Beauty Masked Out French Green Clay Mask, $19 at Ulta Beauty. Sunday Riley All About Acne 5-Piece Set, $95 at Sephora, $133 at Walmart, and $81 at Amazon. This is in our books section of Oprah Daily. Why Judy Blum quit writing and what she does now to fill her life with purpose. Here's her version of her sea change, taken from James Patterson's latest book, The Secret Lives of Bestsellers and Librarians. And this article is by Judy Blum. Different books speak to us at different times. I am now 84, so I was 78 when we started the store. I had decided after 50 years of writing, that I didn't want to write anymore. It wasn't because the stories weren't there. Stories are always there. I just didn't want to sit in a room all by myself and spend another 5 years, assuming I had another 5 years, writing another long book. I just didn't want to do it anymore. As a writer, going into a bookstore, you have no idea what really goes on there. You're treated like a queen, and you do what you do, and then you leave. You talk, of course, to the people who are in the bookstores, who are always wonderful and friendly, but you really don't know. When I was growing up in the 1950s in Elizabeth, New Jersey, department stores still sold books. My mother went to Bamberger's, a store in Newark, to order 3 books that she'd seen advertised in the newspaper. The start of Maud Hart Lovelace's Betsy Tacy series about childhood best friends. Those books quickly became my favorite. I had, by then, read all 14 books in L. Frank Baum's Oz series. I don't remember where those books came from. I don't remember going shopping for them. In my mind, they were just there in our house. Somebody must have bought them for me. In addition to going to the library every week, the whole family frequented the Ritz bookshop near my father's dental office in what we called downtown Elizabeth. In elementary school, maybe junior high school, I remember going by myself to the Ritz to spend my allowance. It was very exciting. I would get a Nancy Drew book, a new one every week. I guess Nancy Drew books were inexpensive then, or perhaps I saved up because my allowance was maybe a quarter. What I loved about the Ritz was the way it smelled. I loved walking around touching the books. I'm still doing the same thing 70 years later. When my husband, George Cooper, and I moved to Key West in 1994, I think there were 5 local bookstores. Key West is many things to many people. When we first started coming down here, we would rent a place for 3 months, so I'd have time to finish writing a book. The next year it was 6 months. And then the question became, what am I going back for? I really like it here. Ask, what do you love about Key West? And everybody says the weather. Then they say, but really it's the people. Key West is a special place with an electric group of active people. That's the kind of place it is. The time came when Key West no longer had any indie bookshops. There we were, with no bookstores aside from one that featured a few new books and mostly remainders. We missed the indie stores. We drive 3.5-4 hours by car to Miami. Books and Books in Coral Gables is one of our favorite places. Mitchell Kaplan is the owner. He runs a great cafe on site, so we would stop for lunch and then shop for books. Then we'd go back to Key West, and George would look for a space that might be good for an indie bookstore. The search went on for several years. He'd say to Mitch, "Come down and look at this place or that." But the rents were enormously high, so Mitch could not figure out how to get it done. "If you guys can figure out a way to get a place," Mitch said, "I will be your affiliate. I will help you in every way. I'll be your mentor." And so, when the storefront space came up in the studios, the new Center for the Arts in Key West, George suggested a bookstore to the board. "You run it," they said. We set up as a nonprofit, and we don't pay any rent, which is how we can afford to do this. Mitch at Books and Books consults and does our book buying. It happened so fast, like in a cartoon. We went from wanting an indie bookstore in Key West to having an indie bookstore in Key West to running an indie bookstore in Key West. And Mitch gave us a crash course in book selling and made it happen so fast. Before we knew it, 1, 2, 3, Mitch sent a couple of guys and the shelves were put up and the tables were brought in And then cartons of books started arriving. We didn't know what we were doing. We weren't even set up yet, and people were coming in off the street to look in the cartons and say, I want to buy this, I want to buy that. One of Mitch's top booksellers came down and gave us a crash course in bookselling. I've never forgotten her advice. You have to get people excited about books and excited about buying books, and they are. That's so amazing. You can walk through the gallery into the bookshop and then up the elevator to the wonderful roof garden where we host events. The view is 360 degrees, the best view in all of Key West. I believe it's a great place. So the fantasy became reality. The biggest thing that George and I didn't know, that we never imagined, maybe we're just naive, is how much work is involved. Having a store comes with responsibility. I am not the entrepreneurial person here. George is. He is the business side of Books and Books Key West. I like to think I'm the creative side. I posted a letter right there on our cash wrap. Dear book friends, I'm so happy that you're here, and I'm so happy that they're there. But I'm not just there to say hello and find books. I'm working. I'm a bookseller. Hey, guys, I say to the staff, our teeny-weeny staff, or our volunteers. We're in business. We have to sell books here. We may be nonprofit, but if we don't sell books, we can't pay our staff, and we can't buy the books, so we need to sell the books. When you have a very small store that carries a lot of titles, 7,000, sadly, books have to turn over. Any book that's in print, we can get for you, but when books don't sell, we have to return them. I really hate that. But it's necessary because there are so many new books and there's so little space. You learn that other side, the bookseller side, because as a writer, you never want to return anybody's book. Our primary customers are tourists, and sometimes repeat tourists. It's not the traditional college spring breakers. It's families, and it's people excited about visiting our bookstore, and most of them now know that I'm there. I sign their books and take pictures with them. I spend a lot of time talking to them and helping them decide what books of mine are right, for which kids in their family, or maybe which are the adult books. Some people are surprised and ask, oh, you write adult books? If somebody says, can you recommend a good book? You have to say to them, well, what do you like? What's your latest favorite? If they've only read mystery, that's great that they love mystery. We have a wonderful section. I show them the table display of new thrillers, then tell them, maybe you would also be interested in this other kind of book. A book I really fell for was a debut novel, The Paper Palace by Miranda Cowley Heller. We learned from our sister store in Miami that people really do respond to staff recommendations. But I don't write good staff recs. When people ask me to write blurbs, I'm just no good at it. But in this case, I wrote a really good staff rec, and we've sold a lot for us, a lot of copies of this book. Every time it comes in, it sells right out. I noticed yesterday that it was gone again. I know that my best blurb is selling that book. No one has complained so far. I think, oh, somebody's going to come back and say, I really didn't like that book. Well, that's okay. That's okay. I think back to the moment and I said, that's it. 50 years. I don't want to write anymore. And then this opportunity came up. So how lucky am I, suddenly able to get up in the morning, excited about what I'm going to do, how I'm going to spend my day. I am excited every day that I go to the bookstore. This is the truth. And there's a book that accompanies this article. It's called The Secret Lives of Booksellers and Librarians, True Stories of the Magic of Reading. And it's by James Patterson with Matt Eversman. That's Eversmann. And it's $20 at Amazon. So we have the word of the week. Intrusive thoughts. Why it's totally normal to picture that stranger in the elevator naked. By Cassie Hurwitz. Did I leave the stove on? Should I steal this shirt instead of paying for it? What would happen if I pushed my partner off this bridge? These aren't just scary what-ifs. They're intrusive thoughts, and don't worry, we all have them. They're part of the everyday human experience, says Chandler Chang, PhD, a clinical psychologist and founder of Therapy Lab, who defines them as instances when a random thought comes into our awareness. Typically, intrusive thoughts are distressing, odd, or unsettling, Chang says. They can also occur when someone is extra worried. Say you're having sex with your partner and suddenly start thinking about an upcoming family function. Does this mean you're attracted to your cousin? No, you're probably not recognizing a real fear that your mom will corner you at the party and ask when you'll give her grandkids. Intrusive thoughts can also increase or become problematic when they occur in tandem with certain mental health conditions, including OCD. Someone with OCD might believe they need to do something to take care of the thought, Chang says. But in reality, a thought is just a thought. Just because you have it doesn't mean it's real or of any consequence. For perspective, she recommends a technique from CBT therapy, holding your thoughts lightly. Question them. Laugh at them. Observe them. In other words, don't judge yourself for wondering what would happen if you randomly kissed the person next to you or smashed your face into your birthday cake. On the contrary, think nothing of it. This article is in Books and Culture and News. How This Styrofoam Cup Held Together a Family. In a new book, the heirloomist Shana Novak gathers 100 unexpected heirlooms and the stories behind them, from celebrities and everyday sentimentalists alike. The takeaway? Our most valued things are never what we ever expect. This article is by Charlie Burlock. Shana Novak's preoccupation with heirlooms began with her own. Her grandmother gifted her a set of cherished sterling silver table settings and china plates, each with a long family history and a rich story. In an act of wild disregard for their perceived preciousness, she actually used them not just for special occasions, but every day, stirring her morning coffee and slurping takeout noodles with silver cutlery, plating a cheeseburger on a porcelain platter. It wasn't that she didn't respect the objects or their history, just the opposite. Living with these heirlooms, knowing their special story, and enjoying them in my own way was exactly why she left them to me, Novak explains. She wanted me to have a greater sense of myself, beyond my skin and bones. Heirlooms can be a great vehicle for that. In her book, The Heirloomist, out today, Novak catalogs the unique ways people live with and through their objects, from dirty tennis balls to Rolex watches. Some of these stories come from household names like Gloria Steinem and Bobby Brown. Others from ordinary people like you and me. All of them make us rethink our legacies and the objects that capture them. Read on for 3 unforgettable stories about the things we hang on to in the histories we can't let go. Graham's Styrofoam Cup. Both of Hannah Sellers Terry's parents worked full-time when she was a kid, so the grandmas in the family stepped in to help raise her. Graham, also known as Barbara Porter, was Hannah's maternal grandmother and was assigned the important task of school pickup duty. Graham would pull up to Hannah's elementary school each day with a homemade Oreo Blizzard in a styrofoam cup in a cooler, on ice to ensure perfect consistency when Hannah got in the car. That is how much she loved Hannah and styrofoam cups. Styrofoam cups were practically Graham's calling card. With grandkids filtering in and out of her house constantly, she'd label her sweet tea so no one would drink it. When the family gathered at her house for holidays, everyone got a cup with their name on it. Even when Hannah would come home from college to visit, there were 2 cups, one labeled with her name and one with Graham's. On the surface, it feels like she wanted people to make sure they knew which cup was theirs, Hannah says. But I really think that she was the kind of person who wanted to make sure you felt cared for, safe, and loved. It was never about the cup. It was about the love and comfort that she wanted us to constantly feel. Hannah says Graham was the quintessential matriarch. beautiful white hair, a friend to anyone she met, and with a large laugh that would light up a room. She was always, always present. Ball game? Never missed one. Gymnastics meet? You bet she'd be there. School play? Front row, says Hannah. She was incredibly special in our family, and we were all close with her. Barbara passed away in 2021, and though it was devastating for the family to lose her, her grandson Hunter found something to hold on to. One last cup, the most constant piece of a memory that is still physically present, Hannah says. Gabby Giffords helmet. Former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords is no stranger to helmets. In 2011, doctors removed a portion of her skull after she was shot. For 4 months, she had to wear a helmet to protect her brain while it healed. She hated it. It was a reminder of everyone and everything taken from me and from our community that day, she says. Years of recovery and healing would ensue. 13 years later, Gabby wears a different helmet. This one. She cycles on her three-wheel recumbent bike almost every day around her hometown in defiance of the partial paralysis she suffered. She rides to reclaim her freedom and mobility. She rides to raise awareness for aphasia, a lasting language and communication impairment from her head injury. But mostly, Gabby rides out of sheer will. Her personal motto is, "Move ahead, no matter what." I love cycling around the city. I love so much blasting 80s music and picking up trash. I see a lot of familiar faces, and I love stopping to chat, Gabby says. I always feel better after cycling. One of her proudest cycling moments was a recent El Tour in Tucson, where she rode 32 miles. Her husband, Senator Mark Kelly, was beside her the entire way. Gabby's speech therapist, Fabi, also joined, surrounding them with her Friends of Aphasia team. Fabi and Gabby co-founded Friends of Aphasia to raise community awareness, provide support, and conduct research for those living with compromised communication abilities due to a stroke or head injury. The ride was a triumph for the woman who had once been in a medically induced coma, and every pedal forward changed her perspective on helmets. Helmets can be clunky and uncomfortable. They can remind you of your vulnerabilities and your mortality, Gabby says. When I was in the hospital, that's what I was focused on. Now, 13 years later, and with my skull intact, I see my biking helmet as something empowering, not constraining. That's what I try to do with other aspects of my life, too. To focus on what I can do and what I do have, not what's hard or missing, she says. Gabby has another symbol of her progress. I keep a piece of my skull in the freezer next to the empanadas. Both are reminders of how far I've come. Tori Burch's necklace. Before her designs filled closets around the globe, before her foundation empowered thousands of women entrepreneurs, and before Forbes named her one of the most powerful women in the world, Tori Burch was a hard-working mom chasing a dream. She still is. This necklace is her most treasured keepsake. The necklace was a gift from Tori's father to her mother. Their love and worldly great taste and their support for Tori would inspire her to bring their brand of style and support to future generations. She credits her father for instilling in her the confidence to embrace ambition. She credits her mother for eternal optimism, effortless style, and priceless advice. Wear the dress, don't let the dress wear you, is one of Tori's favorite pieces of advice from her mom. Tori's namesake fashion label is an ode to this sentiment and to both of her parents. First launched in 2004, the collection immediately hit and note many women shoppers and industry insiders like the sound of. Attainable, approachable luxury. The company continues to evolve, now on a global scale. But behind the trademark tunics, handbags, and ballet flats, Tori always had a deeper agenda. In 2009, she founded the Tori Burch Foundation to empower women and women entrepreneurs through funding, education, networking, and digital resources. Starting the foundation was in my business plan from day one, Tori says. As a working mother who was raised by an incredible mom, I understood the obstacles women face, from access to capital to stereotypes, biases, and limited child care and family support, she says. To date, the foundation, with partners such as Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, Fearless Fund, and others, has provided support to thousands of women-owned businesses and has connected women entrepreneurs with millions in funding and low-interest loans. The foundation has long been regarded as one of the first to focus on serving women in business. But this shouldn't surprise you. Tori has always been ahead of the trends. The necklace, which Tori's mother passed down to her, inspired the foundation's iconic logo. It remains a reminder that dreams can come true if you have the support and ambition to follow them. And the book that they were talking about in this article is The Heirloomist, 100 Treasures and the Stories They Tell. And it's $28 at Amazon. Parts of this article were edited due to time. This is another article in Books and Culture and News. How to Feel Powerful in Every Setting. In her new book, Power Moves, Sarah Jakes Roberts reveals how she learned to become her most powerful, confident self, not just in fleeting moments of accomplishment, but 24/7. And the article is by Sarah Jakes Roberts. It wasn't until people began attaching the term powerhouse to my name and messages that I began to question the accessibility and definition of power. I needed to research power because there was nothing in me that felt like I was powerful. I think that's because I thought that being powerful should feel a certain way. I thought being powerful would ease insecurities and release me from nerves and anxieties. Turns out, being powerful doesn't mean that you'll feel like a big shot boss who takes no prisoners. You'll still have to wrestle with all of the emotions that makes us question ourselves. Being powerful is giving yourself permission to be honest about your capabilities, desires, needs, and feelings at any given moment and without judgment. It is permission to live authentically so that you can show up without preconceived limitations from yourself or others. Sometimes being powerful is actually saying you're tired, overwhelmed, angry, confused, or stuck. In a world that applauds relentless productivity, sometimes the most powerful thing you can do is rest. You see, if we don't confront our definition of power with great intention, we will assume a form of pseudo-power that is infused with arrogance and pride. If you only feel powerful when you think you're performing better than someone else, power will always feel like it's slipping through your hands. True power is not about competing with anyone else. It's daring to truly master yourself. Recently, I asked my social media audience when they feel the most powerful. Most of them answered with particular moments that fill their tanks. The answers ranged from getting their hair done to completing tasks, finishing big projects, first waking up in the morning, and oddly enough, when their toes cracked. I definitely didn't dig into that one. Almost 90% of the answers came down to fleeting moments. I could relate. When I'm completely tapped into the zone and required for me to overcome my nerves and fears to deliver a message, I feel invincible. There's nothing standing in my way. I'm not self-conscious about anything. The moment I finish, I feel like the clock has struck midnight and my carriage turned into a pumpkin. The level of confidence through the force and power on display was something that I longed to experience in my everyday rhythm. It didn't take long before I realized that part of the reason I feel a disconnect between the moments when I was speaking and the moments when I was just going about my everyday life is because I thought that power could only have one expression. Perhaps that's also the reason why most of the people in my social media audience experienced fleeting moments of power too. What if we released our limited perspective on what power is and how it is expressed? Would it allow us to experience the steady flow of power that is ever present? What if you are your most powerful when you're fully present and engaged in what is happening before you? When we practice being wholly aware, we're able to accurately gauge and assess how to respond and connect with whoever or whatever is in front of us. Have you ever spent time with someone and then reflected on the time and realized that you really don't feel any more connected to them than you did before? As a mother, I go through the nightmare routine. But then when my husband asks me something like, "How do you think the kids are doing?" I barely have an answer. It's not that I wasn't with them, but rather that I was so occupied by checking things off my mom list that I didn't have the chance to truly lay eyes on them. Willing yourself to be present in the moment requires that you to shift mentally and emotionally as quickly as your roles do. That's no easy task. When you're able to do this, you'll end up bringing the same power of productivity that makes you great at work into the environment of your home or relationships, where patience is more powerful than accomplishment. Because power moves, we must be willing to ask ourselves, what does me being powerful in this particular context look like? Exercising too much power in delicate circumstances can cause damage. My husband and I wrestle with this quite a bit. We're both visionaries, motivating our teams throughout the day and advocating for representation in industries, usually off-limits for people of color or people of faith. Sometimes, when we're in the thick of tough negotiations, that posture we must take for our mission to be taken seriously in the marketplace is the same posture we bring to who's tucking the kids into bed. Take it from me. The power that worked well when sparring with lawyers will have you clinging to the edge of the mattress with your spouse. The good news is that you don't have to ask that question and act it out all the same time. Let's take a moment and consider all the hats you wear. Child. Yes, even as an adult. Sibling. Friend. Partner. Co-worker. Leader. Parent. Servant. First of all, we can take a minute and applaud just how many things you're doing on earth. There's no wonder you're trying to crack the code for power. Your plate is full. I don't want to overwhelm you with tackling everything at once, but can you take some time over the next week or so and truly consider each role and the circumstance connected to that void you're filling? Then, based on the dynamics of your life and the unique needs of the people connected to you, define power in the context of your roles. You owe it to yourself to uniquely define power based on your capacity and connections. You cannot expect to be powerful at fulfilling a role that is not organic to who you are. It will exhaust you and render you ineffective at producing change. You will never become powerful imitating someone else. Other people can inspire you, but they cannot become your template. If you aren't doing the work to define how power is moving throughout your day, then the things you care the most about will be swept away. You are capable of achieving the fluidity that allows you to honor what matters most to you and the people you are in relationship with. As a wife, I can tell you that me being powerful in the context of my husband's unique needs is being honest, affirming, compassionate, and remembering, at least every other week, that a bonnet is not an aphrodisiac. When I'm tired and running on fumes, it's hard for me to tap into the version of me that shimmies her shoulders and comes alive. But when I exercise the power to say, "Babe, I need help and rest," I find that my shoulders do indeed remember how to shimmy. You're not powerful because you do everything without complaining, even when you're depleted and overwhelmed. You're powerful when you trust that your world can adjust to your truth, no matter how temporary it is. Just because you know you'll get over it soon doesn't mean that you shouldn't honor that it's affecting you now. You're not any less powerful just because you're bruised. For one to experience a powerful life, they must trust that the steady flow of power is never without reach and remove the barriers that make us believe that being powerful must always look the same. There's a book that accompanies this article, Power Moves by Sarah Jakes Roberts. It's $19 at Amazon. Over in culture and news, TikTok is crying tears of joy over a Starbucks customer's incredibly kind gesture. Who's cutting onions? by Danielle Harling. A little kindness goes a long way, and a Starbucks barista learned that firsthand after a heartwarming experience with a customer that's now going viral. In a TikTok uploaded last week, Courtney, at DOPAQUEEN715, shared the sweet details of her exchange with a generous customer. And fair warning, you might want to grab a tissue for this one. Courtney explained that she arrived to her early morning shift at the coffee shop in her usual loud and proud and peppy manner when she came across a customer in need of a pick-me-up. She said that her goal was to get the woman smiling, and she was able to do just that. Shortly after their exchange, the woman handed Courtney's manager a note along with $200 to give to Courtney. The note read, "I travel a lot for work. That usually means late nights and very early mornings. I've been here for 2 days, and so far you have been the only person I have encountered that has been genuinely kind. You were the first face I saw this morning, and you really brightened my day." In tears, the barista revealed that this is her first Mother's Day without her mom. Thanks to the woman's generosity, she'll now be able to purchase the urn she's been hoping to get for her mother's remains. "With that $200 you put in that note today, that allows me to spend Mother's Day with my mom. And I appreciate you so much," said Courtney. The video, which has received over 3 million views on TikTok, has been bombarded with comments from people moved by the woman's kind words and her generosity. "Your mom sent that woman to you," said one user. "OMG, I was crying before you were crying," another added. More of these moments, please. Another article in Culture and News. Blake Shelton just revealed he doesn't miss The Voice at all. He said he would only return under one circumstance, by Maggie Horton. The Voice without Blake Shelton just isn't the same. In 2023, the country crooner officially left singing competition, and we've been holding out hope ever since that he'll return. Shelton has been a mainstay on the popular singing competition show since its very first season in 2011. He coached up promising artists on Team Blake for a total of 23 seasons. That's 12 whole years. In an interview with Entertainment Tonight, Shelton explained that after such a long stint on The Voice, his heart just wasn't in it anymore. "I totally needed a break from that because if I wasn't into it, then it wasn't good for whoever was on my team," he explained. "I don't want to be someone who's just going through the motions. Those artists need somebody fighting for them." The seemingly revolving door of coaches every season on the show didn't help Shelton's situation either. "The second I started feeling like, oh my gosh, I don't even remember what season this is anymore. Who are the coaches on this season?" "I knew that I needed to get away from here," he added. Shelton emphasized that he doesn't miss the job at all, but he does miss certain aspects of his coaching role. "I miss the people. I mean, those people became like family to me, literally from the crew all up to the producers of the show. I was with them more than I was with my family. I miss that," Shelton reminisced. Of course, plenty of good things came from Shelton's time on The Voice, including meeting his now wife, Gwen Stefani. The Hollaback Girl songstress came on as a coach for season 7. "The first season she was on The Voice, we met, but we really didn't talk that much. If you would have told me the first season that we met that what was going to happen, I would have been like, no, we actually don't even have anything to even talk about. What are you talking about? It's crazy how things work out," Shelton recalled. Even good things must come to an end. And as time has passed, Shelton is confident he made the right decision in leaving. "Every day feels a little bit better," he said. For now, Shelton has closed that chapter of his life. But he did say he would return to The Voice under special circumstances if all four original coaches came back together. Shelton coached the first season of The Voice alongside Adam Levine, Christina Aguilera, and CeeLo Green. "If they were ever to put together the original four coaches again, maybe I'd return for one season. A one-off," Shelton told ET. That would be fun for me. That would be something I would be interested in doing. Still in culture and news, Nicole Kidman's daughters, Sunday and Faith, just made a rare red carpet appearance. They look just like their mom, by Mehera, that's M-E-H-E-R-A, Bonner. Nicole Kidman and Keith Urban keep their family pretty much entirely out of the spotlight. But the couple made an exception at the 49th AFI Lifetime Achievement Award Gala over the weekend where Kidman was being honored. The actor brought her entire family to celebrate the big moment, including her and Keith's daughters, 15-year-old Sunday Rose and 13-year-old Faith Margaret. They were joined by Kidman's sister, Antonia Kidman, and her daughter, Cybella Hawley. In the photo, Sunday is next to Keith, Faith is in the middle, and Cybella is next to Nicole. There's a picture of them standing together. Kidman chatted to Entertainment Tonight about bringing her daughters, saying they are old enough now to be able to come and know what this is. My mom is not here, but she's watching the live stream, and so to be able to do this with my family around me gives it such balance. It's very grounding. People also asked the actor what it was like to have Sunday and Faith witness her being honored and said, "You'll have to ask them. I think they're just like they want to get started on their own careers. They are here to support me, and they're very, very supportive and incredibly loving. We're going to do a post-wrap-up at the house late, late tonight. There's a party afterwards, and they're like, oh, there's a party? That's what they're excited about." There are about three pictures that show Keith in a black suit with a black tie and white shirt, and Nicole in a gold sequin dress, and then the girls, one is in a white floral dress, one is in an orange strapless dress, and the other one is in a red strapless dress, all standing together. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Again, that's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, 919-832-5138. So long until next time.